You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
So it is Wednesday morning. I think I have a glimmer of hope that we're not in the middle of World War III. Not that I'm all that sanguine about what has transpired over the past several days. But Matt, you have been very critical of Trump in the impeachment sphere. I heard from one person I know who is a Republican who said people he knows who are on the conservative side who were down on Trump are now inclined to vote for Trump.
Because of Soleimani?
Because of what Trump did and how the Democrats reacted to it. And so I'm curious if you're, has your hawkish button been pushed by this episode?
I mean, maybe this is more example of me being out of touch with the Republicans and conservatives, my concern, I think, is a conservative concern. And it's this. The ethos has always been, at least during my lifetime, peace through strength, and a sense that regimes like Iran only understand power and that they will perceive signs of weakness as invitations for further, provocation. And if you do the timeline of how this played out, you've basically got a whole series of events where Iran would do something like bomb a ship or down a drone or attack oil fields. And Trump would respond by being locked and loaded, cocked and loaded, a lot of Twitter bluster, and then effectively do nothing, just yell on Twitter. At one point, he actually was going to do something and then backed off very publicly. Mm-hmm. At another point, he was waiting for instructions from Saudi Arabia, right? Mm-hmm. I think that sent a message to Iran that they could get away with doing this stuff. So I think that Trump, by showing weakness, escalated this. And then, rather than sort of progressively demonstrating that their attacks would be met with a proportional response, he does nothing, does nothing, does nothing, and then wildly overreacts. And so to me, I'm actually making a conservative critique that Trump invited this to a certain degree. Now, look, I don't want to blame the victim here. I think Iran, they're bad people. They're the bad guy. But I'm talking about what conservatives have been arguing for decades. How do you handle bad people? How do you train them? How do you do a behavior modification? That Trump trained them to escalate, and then he ups the ante so much, the stakes are so high, he takes out Soleimani. The risk then becomes that this thing spirals out of control. Now, as we tape this, Bill, it does seem like things have ratcheted down now, that we're maybe that's not going to happen. But there was a risk that it could have happened, I think.
Well, and I've seen some folks argue on Twitter, not that I should take all my foreign policy strategy from Twitter, but you shouldn't assume that because Iran did this one missile strike that seemingly was intended not to kill anybody, that this is over, that their response may trickle out over time in more asymmetrical warfare with asymmetrical warfare tactics, quasi-terrorist type tactics, cyber warfare, bombings. They may choose to respond, months or years down the road.
Yeah, but they're always doing bad stuff anyway. So right. It's hard to I think that there was the chance that Trump allowed this to escalate so much that they would have had to save face by doing something more extreme. Mm-hmm. It was a bet that Trump made, and maybe it paid off. I just think that through his inaction, he allowed this to escalate to a point where it got very, very scary and dangerous. And I don't think it needed to be that way. And I will say, if people are rallying around the flag based on Trump's behavior, that's a scary thing to me. If what has just happened, him sort of leading us to the brink of war, has caused people to, like, people who were losing faith in him to suddenly come back around, then that's pretty easy to manipulate them. That's a wag the dog type invitation, at least.
There are a number of things about this that unnerve me. One, this is sort of uncharacteristic of Trump. You know, as you point out, Trump has generally been on the dovish side of a lot of these questions. And to some extent, that's good. He's killed less people than George W. Bush. That's sort of one thing I put in Trump's favor. But I also take your point that certain of these actions are signs of weakness that have let bad actors, you know, run roughshod. It seemed like, our information about this is sort of is sketchy, so I don't want to, you know, assert things as absolute fact without knowing the full picture. But it seems like Pompeo and Esper kind of goaded him into it. That they want to take a Soleimani for some time before this embassy attack.
Yeah.
And when the embassy attack happened, they then said, yeah, you don't want this to be a Benghazi, do you? You don't want to be like an Obama, do you?
Yeah.
Then you get the spectacle of Pompeo saying Obama appeased Iran and we're not. Oh, and by the way, Trump's doing great with North Korea.
Right. I think you're right that it's this, you know, Jekyll and Hyde sort of thing. But there's a real danger of mixed messages. Let's go to the conservative assumption that regimes like Iran respond only to power and you give them an inch, they take a foot, all that stuff, right? Maybe that's right, maybe it's wrong, but that's been the conservative, I think, instinct in terms of handling these regimes. When Trump withdraws from Syria, abandons our allies, talks about ending forever wars. I mean, you don't even have to go to all the stuff with Iran, like not responding when they shoot down a drone or something, or threatening to and then backing down publicly. It's other stuff in the Middle East. I mean, he has clearly signaled that he wants to withdraw and retreat from there, which is, look, that's an argument, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of people on the right, people like Rand Paul and Tucker Carlson, my former boss, basically are making that argument. But that's a coherent philosophy. What Trump is doing, I think, is sending mixed messages.
Yeah.
And he may be getting the worst of both worlds.
Well, that's why I completely agree with that. And that's sort of one of the second points I was going to make. I mean, it's taking out a top military figure, even if someone you want to argue is effectively a terrorist, nevertheless, he's still has a military rank in Iran, by drone is, you know, a new frontier of global warfare. You know, we may not be, we are both sort of children of the Cold War when everyone sort of walked around wondering if we're going to be in a nuclear holocaust, and perhaps those fears were somewhat exaggerated because of the mutually assured destruction principle. But you can easily see no other countries saying, hey, you can take out a general with a drone, so can I.
Right.
And maybe it's not an American. Maybe the people might be afraid to go to America because our military is still very powerful. But I'm sure for other countries with less powerful militaries, that might be a thing people do, a thing countries
sure
do. And I don't think that it's, you know, it's a smaller body count, but it's only a very unstable way for a world to function. And so Trump has done that while at the same time not really caring that the Iraqi parliament wants to throw us out. To the point where we're sending a confused letter, you know, it's signed, it's not signed, it's not properly translated. What do we really want to do here? I don't know. Trump's whole body language to his entire presidency is, I want to get out of this region and not be responsible for it. So you're willing to violate sovereignty and take out military leaders, but you're not willing to stick around and actually solve the underlying problems of international terrorism.
Yeah. Right.
Like, and so that doesn't add up to a coherent strategy.
And Sean Hannity last night, I didn't see it, but what I'm reading, he does a monologue where he basically wants us to bomb Iran or something, or attack them in Iraq, but no boots on the ground. No boots on the ground, you know? So anyway, so as you know how these things go, Bill, I've been trying to write a column about this for 3 or 4 days, mm-hmm. and it just kept getting pushed back, and then it kept being overtaken by new events.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to publish or not, but there was a part of the column that I had to take out because it just didn't fit. But you know, the whole murder your darlings thing as a writer, mm-hmm. In order for a column or a book to really work, oftentimes you have to kind of take out something that you mm-hmm. have a personal affinity for mm-hmm. because it's a distraction from the larger premise. Mm-hmm. I had an aside in my column about behavior modification. And because I got thinking, like, as a parent, if you want your children to behave a certain way, mm-hmm. what kinds of carrots and sticks, and what is the best way? You know, for example, if you're going to discipline a child, you don't wait 3 days to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And it needs to be consistent. And so I got researching it, and I stumbled upon some stuff that I knew about a little bit, B.F. Skinner. But he had this thing where it's abusers, people who are like narcissistic spousal abusers. they're not consistent especially when they dole out rewards. It's intermittent behavior, intermittent rewards, and apparently there's actually something psychologically where if the reward is not consistent, if it's intermittent, it actually bonds, it releases more dopamine in the person receiving the reward, and it bonds you to them more. And this is apparently, according to some articles on the internet, something that a lot of abusers and manipulators do. And I got I had to take it out of the column. It just didn't fit. It was a distraction. But I got wondering if the mixed messages Trump is sending, and the way that he's sort of erratic, if that's part of that personality type, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a weird idea, which is why it got cut from the comment. it's interesting.
Let me ask you a slightly different question, though. You mentioned how Tucker and Hannity are reacting differently to this. So what do you think this is doing to Republicans and conservatives generally? I mean, it seems like overall Trump is in control of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
There's vast more people willing to salute than people breaking ranks. Is this scrambling the fault lines within the Republican Party and conservative movement at all, or is it still kind of along the same patterns?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has the potential to scramble a lot of fault lines, right? So, like, what is a never Trumper slash nation building neocon like Bill Kristol.
I mean, has Kristol responded in a positive way to this?
I don't know. How about John Bolton?
Right.
I mean, you know, he should be loving this.
Right.
And then you've got people like Tucker Carlson and Rand Paul. And I haven't followed it closely, but the sense that I get is like, if Chairman Stalin only knew what was happening, you know what I mean? It's like, instead of attacking Trump and blaming him for this, what people say is, some people think is an assassination, some people see as an act of clearly an act of war. Rather than criticizing Trump per se, it's Pompeo. Mm. Clearly, Mike Pompeo, and you even got to that, right? Mm. Look, Donald Trump's the president; he has agency. It very well may be that he's influenced by the people around him, but the buck stops with him. And so far I haven't seen any criticism of Trump for being a warmonger from the right.
Let me ask you about Pompeo, and you know, forgive me for shifting from serious matters of war and peace to crass politics. But we had this episode over the past month where people were assuming Pompeo was going to run for Senate as a precursor to running for president in 2024. And in the midst of him playing clearly a very powerful role in the decision and in the public communications aspect of it, saying that he's not going to run for Senate. And I don't think anyone believes that means he doesn't want to run for president someday. And he might be logical and thinking, you know what, I'm perhaps the second most powerful person in the country right now, and perhaps being a junior senator isn't really the best way for me to become president. I mean, obviously his profile is raised, but is he helping himself with Republican Party rank and file by being the wingman in this operation?
I mean, you know, Bill, you just wrote this piece for Politico magazine about 2024. And I think that that's it's a real question as to how you would want to position yourself, because we don't know what the future is going to look like. We don't know if it's better to be in the Senate or to be, you know, the Secretary of State, or if hugging Trump versus creating some distance with Trump is going to be better. We just don't know that. But he has a pretty good hand to play. And I think he's just decided probably to stick with that hand. And I think you've got to take him seriously. He's a smart person.
Is he? Do we know that?
Well, I give him, I think that he is, very good. When I watch these interviews with him, like on Meet the Press, Fox News, Sunday, I think he is very devious. I think he is very good at parrying questions and staying on message, which requires a certain amount of intelligence. And I think that he has done a pretty good job of marrying Trumpism with a more traditional Dick Cheney style of Republican politics. And so if there's a theory that's, you know, there's a pretty, I think, plausible theory that what you end up with is a hybrid candidate who can blend Trumpism but make it a little more palatable and a little more in line with traditional Republicanism. And if that happens, then Pompeo's, you know, in pretty good shape to be someone who can translate, you know, and be a bridge to those two worlds.
Now, you very thoughtfully mentioned my Politico piece, Who's Winning 2024, which I got a lot of, you know, Twitter hate, you know, delete your account, you know, you're what's wrong with the media. It's not even 2020 yet. What's your problem? No one wants to read this, of course, if I may say.
A lot of people.
Most read article of the day on Politico. Thank you very much. but you know, there are some substantive critiques of the piece, which is you didn't include this or that. You know, this is such a narrow, shallow list. But it wasn't written to be everybody who might run.
Yeah.
The premise was who did the most in 2019 to position themselves for 2024. And I think it's clear that there are people who are doing that. And so whether you think it's too early, I think the fact is people are doing that positioning, and therefore there is value in understanding what is going on.
Well, throw out for people haven't read it, or like me, have read it and have quickly forgotten in the fog of war. Who are a couple names of people who were kind of quietly making moves in 2019 for 2024?
Well, I think the names that I put out there that are probably the least obvious on the Republican side, I'd say Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida.
Very popular.
Well, here's the thing. You know, you go back 4 or 5 years ago, all you could hear about was all the amazing Republican governors. Oh, what a deep bench the Republicans have. All these wonderful outside the Beltway problem solvers. Chris Christie, Bobby Jindal, Scott Walker. John Kasich. And I believe someone on this show might have mentioned that a few times.
And well, that was a trend that went back decades. Yeah. Tommy Thompson. Yeah. You know, I mean, there was allegedly a very strong deep bench of Republicans for decades that were governors, that were George Allen, I guess, before he went to the Senate. Right. You know, I mean, and there was an assumption that governors were who got elected president.
Right. And now the average person could not name a Republican governor unless they have one in their own state. Even then, maybe not. You know, there's certainly no one who's been being held up as like the next guy or the next woman. But DeSantis, here's someone who just barely won the election in 2018. He was basically called a racist by his opponent. He said, "Yo, I'm not saying you're racist, but the racists think you're a racist," which is about as close as you can get to being called a racist. And now he's got an approval rating of 65%. He has had a very productive legislative year. He's been in Florida. He's known as being far more involved in the legislative process than his predecessor, Rick Scott. Some of the things are kind of standard, you know, conservative talk show friendly things. I'm going to ban sanctuary cities. Cities can't make them sanctuary cities. Teachers can have guns in schools, that kind of thing. But he has multiple gears. He vetoed a bill that would have banned cities from banning public straws, plastic straws. He has tapped people. He's created positions, environmental positions, like a science czar. Like he doesn't quite say it's about climate change, but it's clearly obvious that it is about climate change. He's very careful not to sort of push that button and piss off the far right, but he's taking science seriously and talking about climate adaptations for Florida.
Which in Florida is good politics.
That's right.
I mean, it's better politics. Even as a Republican, it's pretty good politics in Florida.
Yeah. I mean, they're getting hit with hurricanes. Their coastline is eroding. Tourism's important to them. I mean, even a guy like Matt Gaetz, who's a super far right Trumper, says climate change is real. So things are different in Florida. But, you know, I think that's useful potentially if you want to sell yourself as someone, hey, I can, if Trump loses.
Yeah.
And you want to be able to kind of straddle being seen as a Trump loyalist, but can still play nationally.
Yeah. And he ran the most Trumpy ad of anybody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
With the Trump babies. It was pathetic. It was like Tom Tillis wishing Eric Trump a happy birthday level cringeworthy.
But Trump's appreciative. And so DeSantis, like the biggest thing here is DeSantis passed a bill that would allow for importation of prescription drugs from foreign countries that are cheaper. It required the federal government, HHS, creating a system to allow states to do that. He works very closely with Trump. There are skeptics in HHS for allowing this, but DeSantis leans on Trump. Trump leans on HHS, and now they have that rule. Some of the rule is not robust enough, and it's not going to pan out very well in the end, so I don't want to say it's all a slam dunk. But the point is, DeSantis has deepened his bond with Trump, carved out unique positions that no one else may have in the field. I mean, this is the thing.
Right.
I can't tell you today what is the right ideological lane one should be in, because there's too many unknowns. But if you spent 2019 creating your own lane, I think you have done something to improve your chances come 2024. And DeSantis is the one governor who's really done that.
And the other thing, too, is although he's close to Trump, he's not public. I mean, aside from that, you know, campaign ad, which, again, was cringeworthy, he's not every day, like, sniffing Trump's throne. I mean, he's not Lindsey Graham. He's not...
Well, he's a suck-up. He's got real power as getting his done in his own state.
But so he's out of D.C. He's got his own, you know, fiefdom.
But to circle back to Pompeo, who I did not include in my list, because I would say within the bounds of 2019, he didn't do anything that was that notable. He was in the midst of his Hamlet Act on the Senate. And even now, even with the height and profile that he's achieved in the first 2 weeks of January, it's still pretty hard, I think, for a member of an administration to out-jockey the vice president to be the successor. Vice presidents have a really good track record in primaries. The only example you can only point to of someone who didn't take off was Dan Quayle. He was an unusually unpopular vice president.
Yeah. But I mean, I would argue the son of the last Republican president took precedence over the vice president of the last Republican.
And I included Donnie Jr. on my list. I think Don Jr. is a serious contender. Right. And I also included Trump himself. Because if Trump loses in 2020, he can run in 2024.
You should call him Don W. Trump to make this comparison apt.
So, I mean, yeah, if you had a son and a vice going against each other, that's a hard thing to game out. But I do think a vice versus a secretary, you give that edge to the vice.
And not to make too much of this metaphor, but Quayle also from Indiana. Just like Mike Pence.
Mother vice presidents. Right. So I gave Pence high billing because it was an open question and still is an open question whether he might get dumped from the ticket. But he did get Trump to say in November, Pence is our man 100%. And if he can hold on to that through the end of this year, and I grant you, you should not take Trump at his word, and Trump could pull something strange at the convention. It hasn't happened in several decades, but you know, Trump's a weird dude.
FDR
did it, and as I had forgotten, I got reminded, had added a clarification. I wrote in the piece that FDR was the last person in a re-election campaign to dump a vice. He dumped it twice. He dumped a vice twice. He dumped Garner for Wallace and dumped Wallace for Truman. I was reminded that Gerald Ford dumped Nelson Rockefeller for Bob Dole, but the way I wrote the piece initially, I said re-election campaign. Ford wasn't running for re-election, so I wasn't wrong.
Technically, you were right. So, Bill, I want to... So, you wrote that piece, and there was a lot of pushback. You were, I don't want to say you were being dragged, but there was some anger at you. But then the funny thing happened is there were a couple of like other stories immediately after yours that must have been in the works that were about the same thing. I think there was a poll that came out.
Oh, I saw the Axios report on a poll. I forget if they commissioned it themselves. They just reported on it. But, you know, I thought I was taking a little bit of a flyer putting Don Jr. in there. I mean, I had reason to do. I mean, I wasn't being wildly speculative. Don Jr. has done a ton of campaigning, put out a book, did an event in Texas where people were sharing 2024 at him. Like, I don't think that was crazy to bring it up. And the notion that a guy born wealthy whose only political resume line is attacking liberals on Twitter. I mean, that's not much different than his father. So there's no reason to believe that the Republican voters won't be just as happy with him as his dad. And then this poll comes out, and I also said in the piece that he's better positioned than Ivanka because Ivanka's reputation is an ineffectual insight player who's ideologically out of step with the party. And then you have a poll that includes both Don Jr. and Ivanka, and Don Jr. runs ahead of Ivanka in the poll. Though Ivanka was not nowhere. She still was more than 10%. But Don, between the two of them, Don Jr. was the person who was
polling. Which is interesting because I think for up until recently, Ivanka was the chip off the old block. I mean, Ivanka was clearly the successor, clearly the Donald Trump's favorite and the one who was probably going to kind of inherit his legacy with the business. And now I think she has been kind of outmaneuvered by by Don Jr. in the political world.
But again, I think if Trump loses, I mean, I could, this is one of the things I put in the piece, I could easily see Trump Sr. the day, everyone on the left is worried that Trump won't leave the office.
Yeah.
He'll just stay there and refuse to leave. And I guess I'm not terribly worried about that. I mean, he can sit his ass wherever he wants to sit. He's not the president if he loses the election. And he obviously, if he was made a big deal about it, you could have obviously unrest.
Well, look, Phil, I don't want to go down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole too much, but I think the worry is, you know, something like a huge black swan event, you know, terrorist attack or something. Elections are postponed, or there's an election that is very close, and Trump argues, you know, we get into like this constitutional fight over like a recount. Like, that's sort of the scenario where.
I mean, even if all those things happen, like, we have a constitution, we have laws. I mean, even in 2000, where things were extraordinarily murky, and I vehemently opposed what the Supreme Court did, I think they shut down a count prematurely. But the fact is, there are institutions that end these things.
But Al Gore also respected the legitimacy of the institution.
And there are people on the left that think he shouldn't have done that. But if he didn't do that, the law is still the law. The count is still the count. The Supreme Court is still the Supreme Court. You can rant and rave all you want. You don't change what those institutions and those laws are.
I'm just explaining the fear.
I think it's more likely in the event that he loses, and maybe he doesn't concede that day, but when he does eventually concede or is literally forced out, I could see him the very next day filing his papers for 2024.
Believe me.
I mean, he filed his papers for 2020 the day of his inauguration. He wanted to signal right away, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
This isn't a fluke. I'm not in over my head. You thought I was doing this seriously. Guess what? I am.
Well, that would be a really interesting test because, you know, it used to be William Jennings Bryan, three times the Democratic nominee. Mm. We don't tend to like losers in this country. Now, Trump will spin it. He will have alternate facts. He may have entire media outlets, saying it was stolen from him or whatever. If that happens, it'll be very interesting to see if he maintains his popularity or not.
Well, and it obviously depends on how the campaign is run. Is it a close loss? Is it a big loss? But we are in the midst of debating, you know, how big of a grip does Trump have on the Republican Party, both now and in the future, if he literally doesn't leave the stage. That makes it harder for the part for, I mean, I'm sure if he lost by a little or a lot, some voices are going to say inside the Republican Party, that didn't work.
Yeah.
That was bad for us.
Well, how many Senate seats do we lose? I keep saying we.
Right.
But how many Senate seats do Republicans lose as Trump goes down in this scenario?
All those things are factors. But if Trump literally refuses to leave the stage and says, I'm running again, that even if you got a pretty good argument for kicking him out, obviously, he has loyal fans who may not care that they lost Senate seats. It feels like he's our best fighter, and he lost this round, but we're going to go get him in the next round.
Yeah, you're totally right.
I say this without any pleasure. I'm so looking forward to the day where like I don't have to like think about Trump and his family. And my deep fear is that day will never come because if it's not him, it's his son.
There are examples of people who were catnip to the media. And then, like, Sarah Palin's an example of someone who is utterly irrelevant today. I mean, I don't know what, like, if they wanted me to interview her for my podcast, I probably would if I got them to agree that, like, I could ask any question. You know what I mean? But, like, I wouldn't view that as, like, yeah, man, that's a get, you know? And so there is such a thing as like the media basically after over a period of time, deciding that you're like now a C-list star. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that process exactly works. It's kind of mystical or mysterious to me. But like, is there a scenario where like they just quit paying that much attention to Trump?
Right. I mean, in the scenario where he loses by a lot and the Republicans lose a lot of seats, some Republicans will feel emboldened to say, screw this. You know, I'm not going to be cowed by this guy. This guy's killing our party. And I don't want to hold on to my seat if it means being, a 40% party forevermore.
Yeah.
But again, we have to see what the final results are before we know what kind of impact this is going to have on the party.
Well, we covered a lot of ground. What else do we talk about?
Well, we haven't talked about, you know, Democrats in 2020. We're less than a month to Iowa.
Yeah.
We finally got an Iowa New Hampshire poll from CBS over the weekend that had three-way tie in Iowa between Bernie, Biden and Buttigieg. And in New Hampshire, we had Bernie with a slight lead, a 2-point lead over Biden, Warren in third, but Warren losing 13 points from the November poll from CBS. She dipped in the Iowa poll, but it wasn't nearly as steep. And since that poll, you've seen Bernie be vocally critical of Joe Biden. You've seen various progressive organizations be critical of Joe Biden, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which has endorsed Warren, Indivisible. So you're definitely seeing the activist left see Biden more as a threat and also see Bernie as potentially their best chance for stopping him. But I think you're also seeing folks, and that reaction to Biden is also acknowledging that Biden's got a really good shot at this thing, that he is, you know, essentially tied for first in both states. What's happening in Iran, I mean, obviously we can debate who benefits from this. Is it the guy saying, I'm going to stop endless wars like Bernie, or is it the guy who seems like a safe, sober choice when everything in the world is going off the rails? So it is looking, I mean, you can't say definitively this is coming down to a two-person race between Bernie and Biden, because clearly Buttigieg and Warren still have cards to play, and you can't totally discount Klobuchar. She's hanging around 7%. People do have late surges. But Bernie and Biden's a pretty absorbing what's the word in boxing for the top card? It's not undercard, it's whatever it is. As a marquee fight, it's a big ideological clash with two people with a pretty robust base of supporters, and it's kind of hard for Buttigieg and Warren to kind of get in there when that's going on. I mean, we had this Buttigieg Warren scrap a few weeks earlier. And it might have diminished both of them in the process.
Yeah.
Because Buttigieg, while he's still competing in Iowa, he was in fourth in New Hampshire, and he's not been rising nationally. It really seems to me that it's more likely that the people who believe they're part of this growing democratic socialist movement, who are excited that it actually has a chance of succeeding, they don't want to give up on that. And the people that really want to beat Trump first and foremost and think that they need someone who's got the broadest appeal as the way to do that, they're not inclined to jump ship from Biden.
I know that you've been pushing back on Twitter against Castro and others who are saying that Iowa should not go first. Mm-hmm. But I guess the thing that seems interesting, and we've talked about this before we started taping, is the idea of people going – like of these – you know, it used to be candidates would basically go all in on Iowa, try to win that to gain momentum. It doesn't seem like that's playing out. And maybe it should be. Like, maybe Pete Buttigieg should be living in Iowa, but they're not doing that, are they?
Well, you know, as I was telling Matt before, and I'm in the middle of a piece for Politico. It's not quite finished. It hasn't published yet. You know, then it always could not publish. So we'll see. But I've looked at the numbers, and you go. So like this is the most similar to 2004, 2008. Wide open fields, multiple people that could have a shot in Iowa. So a lot of heavy campaign activity. You know, 2016 was roughly a two-person race, and it hadn't really got into full gear with Iowa, even though obviously Bernie was working hard. It wasn't the same kind of carnival that it is right now. You had several candidates in 2008 who were in Iowa for over 100 days. Joe Biden was in Iowa for 120 days. and in 2004, Dean was 110. Dean and Edwards in 2004 did the full Grassley, all 99 counties. Edwards again did, Edwards and Richardson did all 99 counties in 2008. You know, Chris Dodd rented an apartment, like basically literally lived in Iowa,
yeah,
in 2008. And now there, outside of John Delaney, who was running in Iowa, you know, back in like 17. No one's going to hit 100 days.
I wonder if this is a Trump thing. Remember, Donald Trump eschewed the, going to fairs and shaking hands, and would basically, to sort of nationalize the campaign. It was media, it was rallies, fly in, fly out. And didn't even have to be in Iowa because people were watching Fox News. I wonder how much of this is just that things have become, it's not, all politics is local. It's not retail anymore. It's now a wholesale game.
Well, I don't attribute that to Trump. I just to DNC rule changes and the primary calendar. The DNC, starting in 2008, incentivized having Nevada and South Carolina go early, and having a big Super Tuesday right after South Carolina. So before, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire were the longtime first contests, very white states, very liberal electorates, and the DNC, you know, responding to criticisms said, okay, Nevada has a pretty robust Latino population. South Carolina's majority African-American as far as the Democratic electorate's concerned. They're going to get in this early stuff too. And then we're going to have this big Super Tuesday, where this year at least, and it was also the case in 2008, it's going to include California and Texas, big states, diverse states, heavy Latino, voices, and also some deep South states, you know, like Alabama, I believe is, on Super Tuesday, which is a strong African-American population. So, in 2008, when this first schedule change happened, the campaigns didn't respond to it immediately. They didn't totally grasp how much more important South Carolina was going to be than Iowa. Now, Iowa was important. I mean, Obama needed his victory there. But it's not like Iowa, sets the pace for everybody. Iowa didn't even have momentum to win New Hampshire. And that was true in 2016 also, though you could argue, well, Bernie got some steam in Iowa, even though he came up short. But you go back to 1984, Mondale couldn't win New Hampshire after winning Iowa. Gephardt couldn't win New Hampshire after winning Iowa.
Well, I think the New Hampshire people are also contrarian. I mean,
Iowa
wants you, we're going to go with someone else.
There is that element to it. And New Hampshire has a lot of independents that can run in the race. I mean, it's different demographics. So, you know, Iowa doesn't set the pace because you get a lot of split decisions, and South Carolina breaks that tie, at least it has in the past two years.
So it sounds like you're saying like this is not the product of like candidates doing like a front porch campaign / primary debate stage campaign and skipping, you know, being on the ground. This is them spreading out to more states.
So Biden and Buttigieg have campaigned in 20 states. I'm sorry, Bernie and Buttigieg. Biden's been in 24. a good number of those states are dipping in for a fundraiser, but still, you're there. You're going to gain some local media coverage when you do it. His fundraisers all have press. He doesn't have closed fundraisers. And Warren has been to 26 states. You know, she's definitely spread the broadest of any of the, both in just her personal appearances and her staff, you know. So you have campaigns raising a lot more money early and spending that money across the board and not concentrating it in Iowa as much as was happening in 2004 and 2008. So that's one critique that I think doesn't fit what Castro was saying, right, and others say about Iowa. The second thing is, the argument is, well, Iowa and Hampshire is squeezing out the candidates of color. These all-white constituencies are not giving airtime to these candidacies. And what that's missing is, new in the DNC rules this time around, is getting on the debate stage from polls, either nationally or in the early states. A South Carolina poll is as good as an Iowa poll. A Nevada poll is as good as a New Hampshire poll. Booker and Harris. Look, Harris was in the debates. Harris didn't get knocked out by the rules. She chose to plot early. So maybe let's leave her out of the equation. But just the point of fact, Booker and Harris spent more time in South Carolina than everybody else. Again, it's not as many days as Iowa. They were in South Carolina for 20 plus days, and the other ones, it's in the tens. And I think what Booker and Harris learned was, I'm having a hard time winning black votes here because they're with Biden.
Yeah.
And the other candidate said, I can't totally snub South Carolina because it's going to look racist if I do that. But I can't go all in on South Carolina because Biden's got this place locked down.
Right.
That's not the fault of white voters in Iowa, that black voters in South Carolina like Biden. And Castro reportedly thought Nevada was going to be his breakout state, and he never got any great polling out of Nevada. And I heard one Castro aide complain to Politico, well, Nevada's not polled as much as Iowa. And that's true to a point, but in the last debate, Nevada, South Carolina, and New Hampshire were polled equally. They had three polls each.
Yeah.
Iowa had more. Tom Steyer got in that debate from Nevada and South Carolina polls alone. He did not have any qualifying polls nationally, not have any qualifying polls from Iowa and New Hampshire. And you can say, well, he bought it. Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how he did it. But if you can't get to 4% in those states after a year of campaigning, it's not the rules' fault. It's your fault.
Here's an idea. I mean, I agree with you that Castro's criticism is BS, but you remember the famous Reagan Manchester debate where he says, I'm paying for this microphone?
Yeah.
People remember it as I paid for this microphone.
Right.
Reagan did, I think, sponsor and pay for that debate so that it would happen.
Right.
Could Castro have funded a poll, a media firm to, in other words, he puts up the money.
He cannot do that.
But a Las Vegas paper commissions the poll. Can't do it?
The DNC has pre-decided what polling outfits are legitimate outfits for their invite purposes. So you can't go outside of what they've already included.
Could Castro go to a Las Vegas newspaper and basically say, I'm going to put up the money and then it's hands off. You commission it. You go with whatever pollster you want.
If it's an outfit that the DNC has pre-approved, and the polling outfit can assure the DNC that who cares where the money came from, we did this in the same legit way we always do, I guess.
But
that wasn't Castro's problem. He wasn't doing well in these polls. Latino voices and African American voices in that respect had just as much say as white voters in Iowa and New Hampshire. And that is because the DNC created a system where they were for polling on the same playing field. And then the candidates have adjusted their campaigns accordingly. Just this month, Pete Buttigieg, I mean, you would think I mean, he needs Iowa. That's his best state. From January 1 to January 11th, he will not be in Iowa. He went to New Hampshire for the first week of the primary. Just yesterday, he was in Texas.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that's – I mean, I'm not sure that's smart. I mean, if everyone else is deciding to spread themselves out, maybe there's an argument to be the one guy who does something different. And look, Pete Buttigieg probably isn't going to be the nominee anyway. But if he can win Iowa, he's putting points on the board. That gives him – yeah, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir, right?
We definitely – I mean, I totally see that argument. And I'd be inclined to say, you know, screw it. It's Iowa or nothing. And you go back to 2004, 2008, you know, that last month, you're talking 20-plus days in Iowa for almost all the candidates. And we are seeing in this first half of January, like, no one is spending all their first 2 weeks in Iowa. No one's doing that. Some people did the first week, but no one's doing both weeks. And some people like Buttigieg didn't do the first 2 weeks at all. Klobuchar finished doing 99 counties in December and then went to Nevada on Saturday and New Hampshire after that. Yeah. Warren was in Brooklyn yesterday with Castro. So, I mean, part of this is trying to have, I think in Warren's case, trying to get media, because she did Rachel Maddow's show.
Yeah. Well, that goes to my front porch type of, not retail, but wholesale politics.
Right. Some of this is fundraising. I mean, you see candidates dipping into non-February states for a fundraiser because they need the money. But maybe the last 2 weeks of Iowa we'll see that concentrated time. But at this point, the candidates are concluding, maybe I can get away with a second or third in Iowa, and I better be sure I can compete after Iowa because this race will certainly continue after that. So I don't need to go all in Iowa and leave risk being short in the follow-up states. I mean, that, whether you think it's the right calculation or not, that is the calculation that they are making, and it's because of the calendar and the rules the DNC has engineered.
Very interesting stuff. What do you want to plug?
Why are you? Check out the 2024 piece. Keep a lookout for my Iowa piece once that's finished. And otherwise, I got nothing else.
So I got to talk with Dick Vitale yesterday.
Wow.
Celebrating 40 years of college basketball broadcasting for ESPN.
Not retiring?
And what's that?
He's not retiring?
Not retiring. He's like, I think he said he was 80. But we talked about, we didn't talk, I'm not a big basketball guy actually, but he's such an interesting dude, and I'm just interested in anybody who can have a career. He was a college and an NBA coach who transitioned into broadcasting. I asked him about that process, learning to be a broadcaster. He only had one eye and he had to overcome being bullied in school. He very recently, about a decade ago, had, the singer Adele, her voice coach, and he had, major throat surgery. To keep his voice going. So we had a whole lot of interesting stuff to talk about. I would recommend checking that out.
All right.
Good interview. I'm also later today, I'm going to talk to David Petruja on the 100th anniversary of the year 1920, mm-hmm. about his book, 1920.
We had him in Northampton at the Coolidge Museum talking about that very book.
So stay tuned for that and check out the Dick Vitale podcast, everybody.
All right. Till next week. Debate next week. So we'll go post debate show.
We'll be here. Check us out.
Take care.
Thanks.